Glenn on Robbie of the Glenn Show at BlackieHits.tv and Brown University. And Harold, you introduce yourself, please.
This is Harold Pollack of the University of Chicago.
So, Harold, here we are talking again. I think it's only been about 3 weeks since we had our last conversation at BlackieHits.tv. But that conversation left us with some unfinished business, and it seemed entirely appropriate, since neither of us in the summertime being academics have anything better to do with our time, that we would just go on and have another conversation and kind of, you know, finish up what we started.
That's okay. Absolutely. With you?
So for my part, okay, so what were we talking about last time? The last time we talked, we were in a heated debate. But you know what, Harold? I can't exactly remember what we were arguing about. What were we arguing about?
We went through voter ID laws. We argued about Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, but there was...
And to the extent that Republicans need to give an accounting, say, in front of the NAACP...
Okay, That was it. The purported justification for our conversation was that... Mitt Romney had given an address to the NAACP convention, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and you had an idea about the speech that he ought to have given, and we fell into a disputation about what the extent to which your ideas about what Mitt Romney ought to have said were right, and that brought in a whole lot of other related subjects of the Republicans' sorry history with respect to race-related issues. And my pushing back against your characterization and so forth and so on. I know one thing that I want to add, I actually, for the first time in my nearly five-year history with BloggingHits.tv, I responded to comments. I actually posted something at the comment site under my name, and it was basically an apology to my audience and to you for having been rude to you and having, in the heat of our argument, perhaps not a, you know, observed the decorum and the kind of etiquette for a fruitful and enlightening exchange of ideas that one would like to foster here at BloggingHits.tv. So I wanted to just take the opportunity to reiterate that.
Thanks. I it's appreciated. It's not necessary. And viewers of Blogging Heads may not know that we know each other for 20 years.
I think it's 25 years, Harold.
Well, I
left Harvard University in 1991. That was 21 years ago. And I believe you had already gotten your PhD at the Kennedy School some years before I left. I was on your committee, as a matter of fact.
You were. Well, but so there's no... so just in case... in case commenters are wondering, by the way, I take credit for your for some of your more liberal stances over the years. I think I lost every single argument, but you ended up years later agreeing with some of the things that I was arguing.
Well, you know, there's this Larry Summers ism, this so-called, this is maybe apocryphal, about Lawrence Summers, the economist and high advisor to the president, former president of Harvard University and professor of economics at Harvard, who is purported... to have said, in fact, I got this from the Susskind book, the tell-all book about economic policy in the first couple of years of the Obama administration. What do you call it? Confidence Men. Anyway, this is Ron Susskind's book, and he tells this story of Summers being confronted by somebody saying, ah, you know, you seem to take both sides of any argument. Summers says, you know, I can argue effectively any side of any argument. And the way I come to a decision is, you know, I argue with myself and then I decide, you know, kind of, you know, which one of the two arguments was stronger. But, you know, when pitted against any other person, he will always win on any side of any argument. So goes this apocryphal story. So maybe it was that way 25 years ago around Harvard Square with a younger Professor Lowry and a very young doctoral student, Pollack.
Maybe so. By the way, I have...
But you were right about some stuff back then. Sorry,
yes, I was. There, if I may say, I was wrong about some stuff too. I also have something to correct. I made a statement about Barry Goldwater, and one of the commenters called me on it, where I basically said that that Barry Goldwater was, I accused him of expressing sort of veiled racial animus. And one of the commenters called me on it, and I talked to a couple historians, and I searched the record for a quote that I had apparently misremembered. And actually, it turns out that there's various things that you can object to about Bird Goldwater and various statements he made about other subjects that I find objectionable.
Yep.
But I was really unfair to him. And in fact, it's interesting, compared to many other Arizona conservatives, he was actually less racist than some other people that are not remembered with that kind of stain. So I think I was very sloppy about that. And there's a lot of interesting things that can be said about Barry Goldwater, but I didn't really say them. So I apologize to you and to our listeners for that as
good,
well.
Good. I mean, I say good only because I remember during our conversation observing that I had, for other reasons, picked up The Conscience of a Conservative, Goldwater's book of, I don't know, what, 1963 vintage or whatever, and I didn't find anything racially objectionable in what he had to say, though he did on principled reasons oppose some of the thrusts of the civil rights legislation that, in retrospect, we all recognize was necessary for the country and proper to do. But anyway, okay, enough on our mea culpas. Let's move on.
That's right.
Let's move on. I can tell you one thing. Summertime and the living is easy when you're an academic and you get 3 or 4 months without regular duties and insistent meetings and all these kind of scheduled things, when you can travel and go places and do really interesting stuff. And I've been doing a little bit of that just back from Kathmandu, Nepal, where I attended a conference, of course. It would have been a conference, right?
Absolutely. As you said, this is the leisure of the theory class.
It's the leisure of the theory class, and we theorists have got to get together somewhere. There's a tremendous political upheaval in the nation of Nepal, 25 million nestled there at the foothills of the Himalayas between India and the autonomous region of Tibet. In China, that's where Nepal is, and they're going through a really momentous time. A Hindu monarchy of over a century's duration, having abdicated, a Maoist insurgency, really a civil war, having been brought to an end with a negotiated settlement that has the Maoists integrated into the national army, these insurgent cadres and their arms integrated into the national army, and a democratic process underway, a constitution to be drafted, a constituent assembly elected to do the drafting of a constitution for the nation, where the Maoists were the single largest party in the, they got the most votes of any party in the elections for the constituent assembly, a social backdrop of 92 languages spoken, of Hindu caste discrimination and, a stratification as a part of the social tableau there, and also with a large number of indigenous, quote-unquote indigenous populations that are ethnically diverse. And they're trying to draft a constitution. And I'll finish this introductory soliloquy. They're looking to place affirmative action, and I'll put that in quotes because they don't necessarily mean by what we would here in the U.S. debate mean by, at the center of their structured constitutional arrangements to redress historic inequalities and to recognize the rights of indigenous populations and this kind of thing. So I'm just back from there. And one of the things that strikes me in coming back, as we get ready here in the U.S. for a debate about affirmative action, the Supreme Court will be hearing this case in the fall, is how high the stakes are in this small South Asian country in this affirmative action debate, how very real and vital the judgments are that they're making about affirmative action policies in Nepal. And I compare that to what feels to me, I don't want to prejudge this, but to be a kind of debate that's run its course here in the United States, and that's kind of winding down toward an inevitable conclusion. But I don't know what you think about that. Anyway,
Intellectually.
Sorry, Hill.
Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I would say intellectually, it's clear that it seems to me that that most of the really interesting arguments about affirmative action were filed in the supporting and opposing briefs in the Bakke case a lifetime ago.
That was a long time ago.
And I mean, they're really, by the way, if you go back and look at them, you see with great passion and sincerity and analytic rigor on both sides, there was a lot of really excellent work presented in the mid-1970s when this was an actually active area where good people really disagreed and where we were just 10 years out of the legal subordination of African Americans. So the issue was really right in our faces. It seems to me that I think there's still important. It's still an important policy issue, but I think it's hard to find that kind of intellectual excitement when you listen to both sides of the debate after several decades later.
Yeah.
But tell me more about Nepal.
Well, one of the things that struck me, I was at an academic conference. It was organized by Yale University, University of London, Kathmandu University, and the Open Society Foundation, George Soros Philanthropy. Mm-hmm. That's where the funding for the conference came from. It was hosted in a luxury hotel, which had been a palace of a local potentate before it got converted to commercial use, on beautiful grounds right in the center of the city, a walled garden with a swimming pool, an ornate gold leaf gilded mirror, beautifully painted column, lovely conference room.
Good digs.
Pardon?
Good digs.
Yeah, digs were perfectly adequate to the Western traveler.
Yes.
The intensity of interest in the conference was stunning. The first session began at 8:30 in the morning. Time. I came down from my hotel room at 8:25 to find the conference room packed. I was barely able to get a seat at the main table, which had seats had been set aside for the principals, those of us who'd be presenting over the course of the 3-day conference. But it was a table that sat maybe 50, a big long oblong rectangular arrangement. And then sitting around the side, there were chairs lining the outer of this room, and everyone was taken. And then there was standing at the back of the room. It was literally crowded in there. I counted 5 handheld television cameras recording the proceedings as the deputy prime minister of the country gave an invocation welcoming us. The degree of interest was such that they had closed sessions where academic papers were presented that were jam-packed, such as I described. And then they also had open sessions where we presenters were asked to reprise our main points of our presentation for public audiences that was held in an even bigger auditorium-like setting where, 300 or 400 people were present. And that was packed with standing room at the back. Members of the Constituent Assembly who were drafting the new constitution for Nepal came to these public sessions, and after they got through speechifying to one another, asked, pointed questions of us. There was a sense of urgency. There was also, and again I'll bring this kind of soliloquy to an end, there was also a kind of recognition that there would be a historic reckoning in the deliberations to follow. The deliberations that they are going through now, that there would be a leveling, that the privileged position of the upper caste Hindu minority of the population who dominated in the business, government, military, academic sectors of the society for many decades, that was going to be shaken, and that the subordination and sort of cultural diminution of the ethnic minorities in the country, that would be somehow reversed. I had the feeling that I was back in the 1960s a little bit, except this time, the revolution was for real. There was a lot of, I thought, utopian rhetoric around the table, a lot of the speechifying about, insisting that history must be reckoned with, whatever, when I thought to myself, reckoning with history was not going to be nearly so easy as you think. You think you can pass a law and gain respect for people who haven't had it for 5 generations? I'm not so sure that backwardness or, you know, being made obsolete by the steady march of modernity and globalization is going to be remedied by, you know, putting quotas into your constitution or, you know, whatever. But anyway, there was just this palpable sense of excitement and urgency. So it was, and I heard Lyndon Baines Johnson quoted four different times at this conference by people, some of them who were speaking in Nepali, the national language of the country. Actually, it's not the national language of the country. That's one of the debates, although perhaps it arguably should be. But in any case, it's the major language. They were quoting Johnson from 1965, talking about you don't bring a man to the starting line of a race hobbled by centuries of chains and think that you're being entirely fair. Whatever, you know, we want equality as a right and a fact, not just as a theory and, you know, whatever. So there was a 60s-esque feel about it, and that was exciting and also maybe a little bit depressing because I thought to myself, these people have not, don't know what they're getting themselves in for. But that's just one man's opinion.
By the way, it's sort of fitting that Lyndon Johnson would be mentioned. Yesterday being the 47th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid, and it's what a remarkable human being in both his what he accomplished and in his failures. There, one thing that your soliloquy brings to mind for me is, you know, we're sort of talking about affirmative action as the frame of this, but there's really the basic distribution of political power is also in the mix here. And so you might say in a country with that kind of history, you might want to say, well, in the political institutions of the country, we want to make sure that the Dalit have certain kinds of representation.
Yeah.
That's actually a very different question from we have a medical school and we want to think about do we allow different standards for people in different castes so that we can create a more diverse medical workforce, which is, you know, and those kinds of traditional affirmative action issues. You know, this is really, we have a divided society, and how do we govern it in a way that's both addressing historic claims and also redresses this fundamental imbalance in power? And it puts the affirmative action debate that we think of in the United States we realize how marginal our debate is because we're really talking about a pretty narrow set of public policies.
I think you got the nail right on the head. Just to explain, the Dalit are the so-called untouchable or low caste Hindu persons who are subject to a kind of ritual, you know, discrimination, exclusion, subordination, humiliation in this ancient system of social stratification.
By the way, you mentioned, if you could just clarify one thing,
yes.
You mentioned in an email the names of some of the castes.
Well, there was one in particular, which this came up during someone's presentation, a scholar who had been doing interviews amongst relatively prosperous, low-caste Nepal people in a village in the east of the country. And he was trying to give us a vivid depiction of the nature of their discrimination. These are people, these low caste, these so-called untouchable Hindu Nepali people, were you know, like artisans, you know, they were like masons or they would blacksmith or work with leather or other kind of craft of this kind, and small business people, and some of them were doing reasonably well. But they were subject constantly to various more or less overt acts of discrimination and humiliation in keeping with the notions about, you know, people being impure, certain kind of contact between people not being appropriate across caste lines, and air marriage not being appropriate. So you're going out there to interview these people. So it's in that context that he reported the name of one of the castes translated into English was caste from whom one is not to accept water and whose touch must be purified by bathing in holy water. That's a crude paraphrase of the translation from the native language into English of what the name of this particular social stratum would actually be. And it was, you know, very sort of vivid in depicting the extent to which these people were viewed by some as pariah. And I got one report after the other, by the way, a personal report from people talking at, mm-hmm. outside of the official conference, Dalit people, low-caste people. One fellow mm-hmm. who presented himself as the seventh PhD, Dalit PhD in the nation. I mean, he was counting and he knew that he was number seven. Of, you know, going to social functions, even in urban areas, even amongst people who are supposed to be enlightened, and finding colleagues of a high caste nature who knew that he was an untouchable, who would find excuses not to come to lunch with him, or, you know, would, in one way or another, avoid certain kinds of contact that were thought by the superstition of the traditional caste system to be, you know, contaminating and so on. So, yeah.
That's just so stunning to me in a couple of ways. One is you realize it's kind of a miracle when institutions change in a country like that, that people don't take revenge. And, I mean, the depth of the humiliation is such that people in the high caste must really be worried that they will, you know, that the tables will be turned. And people in the low caste have to somehow come to terms with some very difficult realities, like, given that where we are educationally, we're going to have to live with a state of some pretty long-term educational inequalities, because the people in the higher castes are the people who are currently equipped to do some of the really important jobs that have to be done. So if we are too aggressive in pushing for policies like affirmative action, which have a very human justification, we would actually damage, you know, the institutions that we badly need. So we're going to have to live with the consequences of this most profound inequality for a very long time, in order to build up our country and to have adequate medical care and all the rest. That's a very bitter pill for people to accept.
You know what, Harold? I mean, it's as if you were there. I'm thinking right now of a. Indian distinguished political scientist who's a professor at Nehru University in Delhi, named Neera Chadhoke. And Professor Chadhoke's presentation at the conference was an elaborate exposition of precisely the points that you've just been making, having to do both with the use of a historical moment where change is being implemented and being enshrined in institutions as a site of exacting revenge for wrongful past acts that had been perpetrated against the subordinate group. She argues against that and argues for the unwisdom of that and argues for the extent to which the resentments that would be built in to such a vengeful development of policy would sort of come back to haunt. And the extent to which the thing that a person, that the formerly subordinated populations are really seeking, well, really is a, maybe mm-hmm. that we should be putting quotes, but one of yeah. the things that they may actually value great, most greatly, is the kind of respect that, as an equal, that is very difficult to legislate or to wring from people by force of law. So that was certainly one of her points. And another one of her points was, be realistic about what it is that you think you can achieve by this process. History does cast a very long shadow, and a lot of the remedy for the harm done by historic violation, subordination, marginalization, and so forth, is to be found in universal institutions, building roads, improving the quality of water, empowering women, building schools and elevating the level of education, providing a public health, a social minimum of decent income to the extent that that can be afforded by the country's fiscal capacity. That would be done on a universal basis, and that would open up the possibility for human development, for the enhancement of people's capacities to live the lives that they would choose to live, and that would be a way out of the overhang of historical subordination, not necessarily and not mainly a redistributive program where we got the pie, it's 100, mm-hmm. and we're going to make sure that our group gets 27.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the social democrat in me says that is, first of all, those are the kinds of institutions that I think societies need to create anyway, but it's also the way that it's the path to deal with a variety of historical injustices. But I think that we don't know how to really talk about humiliation and the reality that we have. You have to somehow address it. I think that it would be nice if these universal institutions by themselves were sufficient. But I don't think that they are. I think that there has to be some kind of historical accounting done in some way that doesn't be, that isn't explosive and that doesn't that doesn't set in motion a destructive cycle of revenge, but that in some way acknowledges the wrongs that were done and in some and redresses them in some form that has the proper nouns included, that isn't quite so universal. And I think that's a really difficult path to walk. But I think, you could say the way to deal with the African-American history in the United States is to create universal health care and social insurance and the rest. And those are the policies that I favor, but I think at some level you have to say, well, there was one group of people that was enslaved, and we have to somehow deal with that.
Well, that's why you have monuments on the mall and museums, and that's why you argue over historical narrative that's going to be taught to your young people in the schools. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will call it political correctness, that you would want that narrative to reflect a certain sensibility. For example, an acknowledgement of the wrongs done to African Americans, both through the institution of slavery and the long aftermath of that institution of second-class citizenship, and a teaching of that to the new Americans who come as the children of immigrants from the continents far and wide. And that's why it's not just another whining, race-centric, liberal nonsense for people to talk about Black History Month or for other kind of symbolic gestures of that kind to be undertaken. I see all of that. I agree with that. And I think, having just been in another country with a very different history, that those points apply, would apply all the more there. And one of the things that worried me in my outsider's observation of the proceedings in Kathmandu, Nepal, was that people seem not to be taking the full measure of the difficulty of this problem. I mean, for example, many people were saying, of course we all know there has to be affirmative action. And they would, so they're like conceding to the claimant groups the mm-hmm. legitimacy of their claim by acknowledging that there has to be affirmative action.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking that, well, okay, that might be a necessary condition, but it's a far, far cry from being a sufficient condition to meet the demands of the circumstance. There's like an air of patronization in it to a certain extent when I heard high caste people say, in effect, well, there has to be affirmative action. But when I realized that so much of the stratification of the society is not administered and implemented through, the bureaucratic selection of who gets a job or who gets admitted to a university, which is what affirmative action would affect.
By the way, your use of the word patronization is interesting because there's two different ways that can be meant. One is I'm patronizing you in a way that conveys disrespect, but there's also this idea of patronage democracy and the way that we, that a patronage system is the way that we deal with this issue. Both of those things kind of come into play here, that if you say a very large percentage of elite university spots are going to go to the lower caste, there will be visible differences in human capital across the different caste lines,
right,
which will lead to all sorts of patronization in the second sense, because you have people who are arriving at very different levels of preparation, at least.
You've basically got two tracks within these educational institutions, or at least you could so end up that way, and then there could be a kind of hidden contempt or sneering kind of patronizing acceptance of these are little brothers who aren't quite up to snuff, but we know we have to have so many seats for them anyway. But then, as you say, there's also the idea that, hey, we won the election and we get control of the jobs, and the Irish are going to get taken care of, or the Italian or the Jews or the Blacks, whatever it might be, in the sort of patronage model of client urban politics in the U.S. as an example.
And we tend to, I think we tend to view, especially people in academia who sort of, we view ourselves as having gotten ahead in a sort of very individualistic way, we tend to really look down on these more collective forms of efforts to achieve advancement. But the Irish and the Italians and so on, did actually achieve upward mobility through some of these methods, and it's a time-honored method political and economic advancement for many people around the world, it comes with heavy costs, but it's not
Absolutely.
An absurd approach.
Which brings us back to affirmative action in the U.S., I think,
yeah.
because, you know, I'm put in mind of this wonderful book by Ira Katznelson. I so admire this book called When Affirmative Action Was White.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now the Supreme Court's going to hear affirmative action cases about college admissions and racial preference. And a lot of us think that this conservative court may strike down affirmative action in some form or another, and we should talk more about that. Katznelson's book, however, makes the observation that long before anybody ever heard of Lyndon Baines Johnson, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was trying to put the New Deal together, he had to deal with a Democratic coalition that consisted of a lot of Southerners who were bent on protecting the Southern way of life, you know, which was Jim Crow segregation, and who were necessary for the New Deal coalition. Never would have gotten that thing done without their votes, and so had to be, in one way or another, mollified or accommodated in the negotiations and in the structuring of the American welfare state that was being built in the 1930s. And in so doing, through the particulars of how the New Deal, various New Deal statutes would be administered, through deference to local authority, to exempting certain occupations from protection of the wage and hours and so forth, and mm-hmm. employment insurance benefits, through various labor law provisions that made organizing the South more difficult, and many other provisions besides, kind of built in racial bias into the foundation of the welfare state. Not so much explicit discriminatory bias, but tacit bias in that provisions were designed in ways that were less beneficial to the sort of emancipation and equalization of African-American populations largely in the South. Okay, that's a long way of saying that the idea of state policy oriented toward the interest of particular groups defined by ethnicity or race is not something that dates from the 1960s or the 1970s. It can be traced a lot further back.
It's in the DNA, absolutely.
Yeah, one example of it is client patronage politics at the urban level with ethnic voting blocs, and another example of it is the tacit racially discriminatory character of the foundation of the welfare state in the 1930s, reflecting the interests of Southern Democratic segregationists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm also thinking about just the fact that the migration of African Americans out of the rural South into the cities of the South and also of the industrializing Northeast and Midwest of the country was delayed for decades. When African Americans might have been at the head of the queue of the various ethnics coming into the urban and industrializing America, instead of coming behind the Irish and behind the Italians and behind the Russian Jews,
yeah.
who were coming from the 1890s onward, instead of arriving in these cities in the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s, when they had relatively little power. These are native sons of the soil. These are people who were citizens of the country and whose ancestors for generations prior to them had been citizens and had been in, effectively an indigenous population here in the United States. And yet they were at the back of the queue of the ethnic urban working class mobilizations that occurred between 1890 and 1950 in the United States, and that ends up hobbling them. So the idea that one might talk now in the 21st century about a rectification of this history, while it may not be politically viable and it may not pass legal muster with the Supreme Court, historically is not at all, and viewed in cross-national comparative perspective, is not at all a crazy thing.
That's a really interesting point. I don't know. I think Katznelson's book is regarded as a sort of emerging mini-classic, although I have not read it. I think it's quite compelling in the arguments that I've seen drawn from the book. By the way, I want to come back for one second to this aspect of humiliation, and then I'm going to pick up on the point you just made. Now, I was thinking about Mitt Romney's trip, and he's made various gaffes, which I don't think are particularly interesting for us to discuss.
Yeah. The Olympics thing is not so interesting.
Yeah, that's just, you know, you just hope your opponent says something awkward and you know, good for us. But when he was speaking in Israel and he spoke about the cultural differences between Israelis and Palestinians accounting for the tremendous difference in per capita GDP, I think that actually bears on some of the things that we were talking about. Because I mean, for obvious reasons, he left out the role of the Israeli occupation in hobbling the Palestinian economy, which is just a ridiculous thing. But there's another thing that I think also bears mentioning, which is that what Israelis and Palestinians both need, in some ways, like what some of the castes need in Nepal at this moment of reconciliation, they need someone. They need help. Finding a way to reconcile with each other and having someone who can be an honest broker to do that. And you know, the Palestinians are in a position of profound humiliation where this comment, it won't affect the election, I think, at all, really. I think people will forget about it. But the Palestinians won't forget about it because it's a particularly wounding and humiliating way to describe their predicament. And it puts them in a position where for them to reconcile with the Israelis is, you can imagine a President Romney saying to the Palestinians, you have to make some painful concessions, say, about the law of return or other things that are dear to them, which they really do have to make, but which take on an additional element of humiliation if the person who offers that has basically just denigrated your own capacities as a culture to be successful. And, it seems to me that there's such a really destructive thing that you know that will go unnoticed in the election, but is really a drop of poison into a process that has a lot of poison in it already.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that. Okay, because I thought the same thing when I heard it, and it just made my heart sink. Okay, and it's not like I've got anything invested in Romney. I don't. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to vote for Mitt Romney. That's not it. But it just made my heart sink to hear that argument made. And what I thought about when I heard that was something that President Obama said, I believe it was during the campaign, but it might have been just after his election, at an APAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee meeting, in which the gaffe of President Obama was to allow that the Palestinians had suffered. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
The president made some reference to Palestinian suffering, and that was meant to be some huge gaffe. You know, how dare he? Okay, and I thought, geez. You know, so not that I would be surprised that at an APAC meeting, the zealotry there would be indifferent to or unable to comprehend Palestinian suffering, but that I thought that the shrewder members of the audience might recognize that the president's acknowledging the existence of such suffering, this is Obama at 4 years removed, would be a good thing for the general process of being able to get people around the table and get them to agree to something. I mean, it wasn't really taking anything away from, you know, the Israeli aspiration or the Zionist aspiration to acknowledge that the Palestinians suffered.
No, and it also is, of course, a reality.
It's a reality.
So anyway, so go ahead. Point,
which is, I just want to say, you know, Thomas Friedman has been writing this column for a long time. It's not quite the same column. I mean, one of the Thomas Friedman columns that I recall is called something like Israeli Oil. Okay, he's comparing Israel to the Arab nations surrounding, and he's saying the Israelis may not have much oil, although there could be some out there under the waters of the Mediterranean.
Yeah, natural gas, yeah, that's right.
They may not have much oil, but they've got, you know, a mini Silicon Valley. Okay, they've got a culture of entrepreneurship. They've got great universities. They've got an open society. They've got inquiring minds. They've got startups. Okay? In other words, they have the stuff of modern advancement. They may not have the physical stuff, but they've got the stuff, the cultural stuff of modern advancement. And, of course, it's true that there is a gulf, a significant gulf in the extent of integration into the global technological and economic engine of prosperity, yeah, as between Israel and some of his neighbors. But I thought that the making of that argument as if it were some kind of essentialist cultural characterization, well, these people are just like this and those people are just like that, was superficial. And it's one thing to make that argument comparing, I don't know, Saudi Arabia to Israel or Jordan to Israel or Syria to Israel. It's another thing altogether, and a worse thing, in my view, to make that argument, comparing occupied, subjugated, historically defeated people.
Oh, and if by
who are being ruled over, it's not as if the Palestinian diaspora can come in there and do anything that they want. That people can own condos in Ramallah and can move their money back and forth out of the country, and can that you can draw on a global community who understand themselves to be a part of historic nation building project in order to create a society on the West Bank and so on. So the comparison is completely unfair and ahistoric.
By the way, if Romney had, if people are wondering why that's offensive, if he really had guts, you could have made that same comment about Great Neck, Long Island, and Lubbock, Texas. And if you think about, if you say, well, wow, that would really offend a lot of people, that sort of gets to what a cheap shot that is. It's interesting. I think there's the seeds of that Palestinian diaspora helping the West Bank develop economically in the way that you described. But, of course, for that to happen, there has to be a resolution of the military conflict so that people can do that. I mean, in the long run, I think Israelis and Palestinians do have to find a way for that, for real economic growth to occur and entrepreneurship to take hold and so on. But obviously, we're in agreement there. But getting back to the U.S., so the Supreme Court may pull the plug on affirmative action at some point in some explicit way. You think that's pretty likely?
I mean, what I think isn't worth very much because I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. I consume these opinions as they come out. Mm-hmm. But it looked to me like splitting the difference thing that Sandra Day O'Connor did in 2003, in which she credits that a university might have a compelling interest in seeing that its student body was ethnically or racially integrated, and that the use of affirmative action is subject to certain, limits. I mean, it would have to be judging people on individual cases, not having some quota, but in any case, the use of some forms of affirmative action would be a narrowly tailored and therefore constitutionally acceptable policy to deal with a compelling interest. That thing looks like it's hanging by a thread to me.
Yeah. By the way,
so it could easily go down.
I think I would hate to see that because I support race-sensitive admissions policies. Most of our master's students are social workers, and it seems to me we have an obvious dearth of African American men, for example, who are just desperately needed in a lot of roles, and I would like to consider that as one element. I think we will have a very interesting dilemma in academia if the Supreme Court really shuts affirmative action down. I think many of us are very view as illegitimate the way that conservative state legislatures have tiptoed up to and sometimes across the lines dictated by Roe v. Wade. And how will we respond if the Supreme Court in some very emphatic way says you cannot consider race in university admissions, when many of us who sit on admissions committees and so on believe that that is, would disagree profoundly with a decision like that? How would we respond through passive resistance? What would we do? It seems to me it'll be a very interesting dilemma, and it should cause some soul searching about our conflicting values in a constitutional democracy. What deference is owed to courts? To what extent does our social justice vision allow us to push back against various legal rulings and so on?
Yeah, well, and let's come to this larger question about what responsibilities we have when we're, politically committed and we live in a plural society and we may have strong values that are inconsistent with the way the law is developing. I think there's more to be said about that, but I just wanted to say in direct response to the question, what do universities do if affirmative action gets stricken down? My prediction is that they find a way around whatever it is that the Supreme Court says, and that they continue to do a kind of subversive affirmative action or a kind of tacit affirmative action that will be much less efficient than the overt affirmative action, but that will still be able to keep the numbers of the underrepresented minority groups, we talk here of blacks and Hispanics, keep them above where they would be if you did it, if you had no concern about affirmative action at all. They will do what I have called in some of my academic research. I have a paper with Roland Fryer, the economist at Harvard, and Tolga Yuret, who's a Turkish economist and was a student of mine here at Brown. The paper's called Colorblind Affirmative Action, and it's published in the Journal of Law and Economic Organization in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. Won't be hard to find. Colorblind Affirmative Action. And in that paper, what we do is we say, suppose a university wants to keep the number of minority or disadvantaged, underrepresented minority students up above the very low percent that it would be if they just did a kind of blind admission and looked only at test scores and at college or high school grades. Suppose they wanted to do that, but they were enjoined from having any kind of separate standard by race. In fact, suppose they couldn't even know what the racial identity of an applicant is in a specific application, then what could they do? And the thing that they can do is they can do a data mining enterprise where they take aggregate statistical information about the correlation between non-racial and racial variables in the general population and exploit that in order to see which of the non-racial variables, for example, participation in athletics, or for example, letters of recommendation from your high school counselor, or, for example, whether or not you were in extracurricular activities, or did you volunteer time at your church, or did you come from a high school that has a particular socioeconomic profile proportion who were getting subsidized lunches or things of this kind. Mm-hmm. Other of these variables, none of which are race, but which may be correlated with race, may be more likely to occur. Was your father at home? You know, do you come from an intact family? I mean, I'm making these things up, and I'm not advising any particular policy. I'm just making an observation that such variables exist that are correlated with race.
I think we already do that. By the way, I think that already goes on quite a bit. And if you're sitting in any sort of a discussion in any sort of elite academic setting, when you talk about admissions criteria, I think very often in the back of people's minds are exactly the correlations that you suggest. If you said, I really want our Masters of Public Policy at University X students to have greater grasp of calculus, and you're sitting and talking about that in a faculty meeting, you can be certain that people have already done that mental calculation as they raise their hand to respond to that comment.
To object to that comment. Right, because if we know that if we require calculus, that's going to cut the number of blacks that we get, and that's not a good thing for us.
Yeah.
That this kind of thing. And just to complete the thought, the idea was that you can do this, okay? So you can use these proxies, and in a way you're forecasting the race of the purportedly raceless applicant by looking for these indicators that you think are correlated with the person's being black. And then you can give those indicators, which are themselves non-racial, though correlated with race, weight in the admissions process, or in the case of the calculus mastery, negative weight. Right, because that's one that I think it's correlated, but negatively correlated with the likelihood that the applicant is black. So I would downgrade it. And the effect of doing that is you will get the racial representation that you want, but you will do so, as we demonstrate quantitatively in this paper, at great cost to the efficiency with which you are selecting your student body. You see the point.
I'll just note one irony of that, which is that the biggest impact of that process will be within the group of non-Hispanic white applicants, who are probably the great majority of the applicants. So you completely change the rankings among whites of who you want to admit in order to ensure that you get 15% of your class being African American or whatever the goal is there that's implicit.
Absolutely. That's exactly the point. You're changing the admission system for 100% of the students in order to get 10% of them to be black and Hispanic. And most of the lost efficiency of selection is going to be because you're going to be selecting white students differently than, and Asian students differently than you would have selected them, because you're using these backdoor ways of getting racial representation. And we calculate that the efficiency cost of doing that can be quite substantial. I mean, of a magnitude comparable to ignoring test score information and admitting students on the basis of everything else in their application except their performance on the academic test.
That's interesting.
You lose as much in our data. You lose as much performance enhancing selection efficiency by in practicing colorblind affirmative action as you do by throwing away the information that's in the test scores of all.
The one thing, just as we close, I think we can probably close the door on this particular subject. I would say there's one caveat I always give in a discussion like that, which is that these are important discussions within highly selective admission environments. And there's a whole different discussion that needs to be taken place for the huge number of colleges, for example, in the United States that are essentially non-selective or for whom the key issue is, can this person graduate as the criterion as opposed to what's the optimum student body based on the NACHIS that we're trying to generate from the Brown University entering class. So I just would throw that out. Another blogging heads, we can talk about that. But
let's do one more topic. I mean, we're 50 minutes into this conversation, which I think is a good long time. Yeah. But that terrible shooting out there in a movie theater in Colorado, in Aurora, Colorado, you had brought that to my attention as something you thought we might remark about, and let you have the first word.
Well, I'll say a couple things about it. One is I will hit my hobby horse of health reform in one simple way, which is I have a pop quiz for you, Glenn. If some nut injured you in an incident like this and you damaged a nerve in your arm and you needed some physical therapy, how many sessions would your insurance plan let you have?
You're asking me that question?
Yeah, no, I'm assuming the answer is I have no idea.
I have no idea, but I'm hoping it's enough. You're going to tell me it's not enough.
What I will tell you is that people often say, why is the health reform law 2,000 pages or whatever it is? The fact is we have a bunch of young people, none of whom know the answer to this question either, who suddenly have life-altering injuries.
Okay, these are dozens and dozens of kids who were people who were injured, not killed, though, by the shooting in that.
So there's a bunch of boring things about health reform, like eliminating the cap that insurers can put on catastrophic injury claims, the dollar caps that many insurance companies had, which were eliminated by the new law, or annual caps are being phased out, that are going to be really important for these young people. And there's things like what's called the essential health benefit, which basically says that insurance plans will have to cover a reasonable standard of care if you need physical care or whatever. We can go down the list of things that are really boring and mechanical, except for to people that now require them. So I'll just say that's just one point that if you think about what actually has to happen for dozens of people injured, you start to realize some of the really boring, down-in-the-weeds, wonky issues in health reform actually matter for these human lives.
Can I just push back a little bit, Harold, on that?
Sure.
I know you have another point. And it would be to say, I mean, we're both policy analysts, and we understand that because I can cite benefits doesn't mean that I've made the case for the policy.
Yep.
So a terrible incident like this will occasion all kinds of argument about, gun control and all that, and it will also be the instance in which people can say, well, I have injured people here, and look how they're being helped. And I'm not going to be against the helping of those people. Of course, it's a good thing for them that they're being helped. But that's, I would just say, not necessarily a case for the policy, since I don't have a systematic assessment of the costs and perhaps of the unintended consequences of such a mandate. I haven't studied this, and I don't say that they would be disqualifying, and not at all. I mean, maybe this is a great thing. I just say, by citing how these victims are benefited, you haven't necessarily...
No, you're actually... That's a very good point. What actually... The Institute of Medicine was charged with basically defining the algorithms through which questions like this would be answered. And what they said, if I could boil down a long report into something small, is firms, if you buy insurance in the individual and small group market or on the new exchanges, they have to offer a reasonable standard of care that matches what the typical small business would offer. So the fact is you and I already have pretty good insurance for something like this to happen. And there's a yardstick that says, if you're just an individual buying insurance and you don't have the University of Chicago or Brown to back you up, the insurance that you buy has to be reasonable by the yardstick of what's offered in these kinds of plans. And so there does need to be a cost-benefit calculus made, but because you have an incomplete contract with your insurer and for reasons that you and I could discuss and induce narcolepsy in our listeners, because there's an information asymmetry there, there's a basic standard that says you should be doing the reasonable standard of care that firms are employing when they cover their own workers if you're selling to individuals and small groups. I'll make a second point. I do think the gun control issue, I wish we had a different word from gun control. I think gun control is one of those words that has become a cultural signifier. You know, we need Frank Lutz and somebody to do some focus groups to come up with some different words. I actually think there's a really difficult set of issues around gun control that have nothing to do with this Aurora case. And I went through 200 consecutive homicides in Chicago at one point for the crime lab of young adults. Not a single one of those that I can recall was with an AR-15. And I'm struck that even the assassins for drug gangs don't need assault weapons with high capacity magazines. And what amazes me is the lack of a communitarian discussion that says, you know, I understand why a guy who has a small grocery store in a dangerous neighborhood might want to have a handgun, but when I sort of, you know, why do people need this high power weaponry around? There are people who like to target shoot. There are people who, you know, enjoy having these weapons. But essentially, their major use is to efficiently kill a lot of people. And it's just astonishing to me that we've allowed the public conversation to stagnate. You know, it's funny. I don't know if you've ever read Crime and Punishment, but there's a great scene.
I have read Dostoevsky. Yes, absolutely.
There's a great scene where Raskolnikov is confronted by a detective, and this detective says to him, well, you know, you had a theory, and, well, it was a bad theory, but at least you only killed two people. And, you know, if you had a worse theory, you might have killed thousands of people. And I'm just thinking, you know, here we have a year 2012 Raskolnikov.
There's some people with worse theories, and they now have the means to actually carry out that.
Yeah, and they get on the internet, and they buy body armor and so on, and there's an insanity to that, which has nothing to do with what we think about a lot of issues around the Second Amendment. It really,
we're in complete agreement about that. Mm-hmm. It does feel insane. But there's an ideology that's behind it that I think warrants closer examination. I heard a debate on the radio between a critic of unrestricted purchase of assault weapons and, you know, 100-round magazines, mm-hmm. and a defender, mm-hmm. of them. And it was the critic, I wish I could remember his name, has written a book about how this debate has gotten off the rails, in which he goes into the ideology of anti-government, kind of cowboy mentality. We need to keep our guns, because if the state gets our guns, that's the first step toward tyranny.
Yeah, we can resist tyranny through maintaining in private hands the capability.
Right, because the capacity potentially for us to act violently on behalf of our own defense, when ultimately the people coming at us needn't just be a criminal, but also might be agents of the state, a state that has overreached. Okay, an ideology that practically invites people, people who may be unstable, to think about killing government officials with whom they strongly agree over public policy.
Isn't that, by the way, what's interesting is it unites. I'll let you finish your thought, and then I'll...
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, and another piece of this is this kind of outsized fear about criminal victimization. Because the guy who was defending the guns, when he was asked, why do you need a magazine, the first thing he said was, well, I have a right to it, it's in the Constitution. And then the second thing he says is, if the people assaulting me are sufficiently well-armed and numerous, I might need to have that many rounds in order to defend myself. Mm-hmm. So he's envisioning some kind of scenario from an action film in which, you know, the bank robbers come running out and take his wife captive, and there's like six of them, they're hiding behind a car, and he needs one of these massive things in order to fire off 100 rounds in 30 seconds to be able to deal with the assault. And my idea is a view of social life in which the imminent threat of victimization is hanging so vividly in front of the mind of a person, and they feel like they have to arm themselves against that one in a gazillion case.
It's also
really apocalyptic.
And it's also it is apocalyptic. It is also it's really pushing back against the fundamental idea that the state should have a monopoly on the use of force and it's something. It's, by the way, I think this is probably a good way to bookend our conversation, that I think all the topics that we discussed today illustrate how basic political philosophy and really thinking about the role and limitations of political institutions ends up being quite fundamental to some pretty granular policy disputes that seem to be much more narrowly drawn than that. But you know, you start talking about gun policy, and at some fundamental level you realize people have different ideas about the role of the state and the way that we hold the state accountable and our ways of evading the power of the state. And you know, there are some really fundamental normative conflicts out there that lead to policy disagreement that we tend to want to say are based on narrower grounds.
Well, you and I are on the same wavelength of that one, and political philosophy is not just idle, you know, counting angels on the head of a pin, though abstract and theoretical, it's this kind of like timeless intellectual project trying to come to terms with, you know, power, institutions, governance, representation, citizenship, you know, public morality and stuff like that, and we haven't outgrown the need for political philosophy.
No, and it's almost as if our policy views are dictated by the writings of long dead you know, political scholars.
To paraphrase, is that John Maynard Keynes or somebody?
It is, but butchered beyond description.
All right, Harold, I guess you got an education at Princeton and Harvard, huh?
There you go. Well, yeah. So great talking to you, and
my great
we'll
pleasure,
catch up soon.
My friend, and we'll talk again.
Okay, I'm gonna. Okay.
Take care.